morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. With me in the studio today is John Holm of Northern Lights Garden and...
Garden Center.
Fame. And John was, in fact, my first employer boss in Fairbanks. John and I have spent many, many, many hours together planting tomato seeds, and tomato seeds are very small.
Yes.
not the easiest planting I've ever done. Welcome, John. Did you plan on gardening or farming when you came up here?
Oh, I mean, yes. I didn't know anything about it. I studied to be a doctor. I studied to be a professional musician, but I wanted to get out, and I guess I was one of the original hippies, although I was more of a white-collared, hair-comb type of hippie. But I just wanted to live out in the country and rear our children away from the city life.
What was grown here generally at that time? I have a feeling that the plant varieties have increased and the vegetation, because of introductions that various nursery people and just normal citizens have made, is... change things a bit. What was grown in gardens then?
Well, in gardens, the vegetables were about the same as they are now. In fact, I believe a lot more was grown then than is grown now, because it was a matter of necessity. You couldn't get fresh vegetables. Not everybody, but a lot of people had a dirt cellar that they kept a sack or two or three of potatoes out of their garden. Today it's so convenient to run down to the market basket and get what you want on a daily or weekly basis. But fresh things were pretty hard to come by, and once in a while there was a boat strike like there was the fall of 46. And potatoes were 65 cents a pound in the Lavery Market on 2nd and Cushman. Well, that was pretty tough in those days, so you were lucky if you had your own food. And so we were a little more self-sufficient then, and people would grow as a matter of necessity and economy. I think some people, it's a cop-out for them to say, well, you know, I really don't have a green thumb. Since I'm not looking anybody in the eye, I can say this is a cop-out, because if you cared, if you care about your plants, you'll find a way to make them survive by learning what you did wrong. Or you'll, instead of watering them on impulse, you'll check them every couple, 3 days, or whenever they need it, and you'll monitor them. If you monitor your plants with a semi-intelligent look in your eye, you'll see what's wrong, and you'll get a 90% result instead of a 20 this year and 100 next year.
Attention seems to be a really important factor, going out there and looking at what's going on under the leaves. And
Exactly. And knowing what you're looking at, sure. If you say, hey, it looks a little pale, don't necessarily run to the nurseryman and say, well, what is this? Take a good look, take a microscope out and say, well, I got a bug and it looks like this. And it might be a two-spotted mite, or it might be an aphid, it might be something. At least you can tell somebody what you've seen, rather than haul the thing in and I don't want any more bugs in my place of business. So I tell people, put it into a bottle.
If you take bugs into the nursery, put them in a bottle, seal the bottle. Don't come in with a pocket full.
We got enough of our own.
Actually, that's one of the things that I find a real pleasure about the gardening process in Fairbanks, is that we don't have as many bugs or infestations as you do in other places of the country.
Oh, that's very true.
I gardened in Oklahoma for a while, and it just seemed that every 2 or 3 weeks there was another hatching and another infestation.
Well, we have three major problems here. The mites, the aphids, and the root maggots were the three major ones. And the root maggots attack the coal crops, of course, and the mites attack most everything. There are occasions when white flies in your greenhouse will take over, and if they do, you better quit for that year, practically. But the aphids we can solve with a couple, three sprayings in the springtime. I usually tell people about the time that the leaves are half out, if you'll spray them, and then again about a week or 10 days later, if you'll spray them again,
what are
you'll
you
get 99%. I use ornithine myself. It's a wide-spectrum type of thing. It will take care of most. That's what we do. We have a mist blower that will spray it's about a 2-3 inch blast of mist about 20 feet, and I just spray everything in the nursery, and we get 98% control if I do it twice like that. We would be, it'd be very difficult to manage professional establishments without some chemical control.
Mm-hmm. The purely organic gardening is either highly labor intensive or more suitable for smaller areas. But of course, there's been a tremendous turnaround in this country for more natural gardening from what it was in the 50s and 60s.
There are some things that work and some things that are just old wives' tales. If you think you can control the bugs with soap suds, you go right ahead. I'd go broke if I tried it. But it salves the conscience of people who can use the time, like you said, labor intensive. If they can use the time to pick off the bugs and to hand treat them, why they will feel much happier in a free environment that way.
Certain plants are attractors of aphids.
Yes.
More especially.
Peppers and eggplants. Several varieties of aphids, of course, but the regular aphid you see mostly, it just seems to love choke cherry trees or European bird cherry, they are properly called. The word choke cherry has been so permeated this valley that to be correct and call it a European bird cherry, it no longer...
Nobody knows what you're talking about.
Nobody knows what I'm talking about. It's also called the Mayday tree.
We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a couple of questions, not pertaining to vegetables, but more to flowers.
Fine.
Last year I planted a long row of marigolds, which did beautifully. I got them at a place on College Road. And about three-quarters of the way through the season, they all died. And I believe it was a root rot, but I didn't see any bugs or animals in there. And I wondered if there was something I had to do to the soil this spring in order to prevent that from happening.
You see, the roots being the source of food and water for the plant, there are several things that can cause the plant to die. One is the infection of that root, so it can't bring in the water. One is the water logging, which doesn't allow any oxygen and or exchange of nutrients to occur. And one, of course, is the over-fertilization, which draws the water out of the plant rather than the other way around. The plant should be drawing the water out of the soil. So it's awfully difficult to say which one of these could be the cause. If you look at the roots, in your memory, look at the roots and see, did they turn brown while the plant was still semi-alive? If they did, if the roots turned brown before the top really did well, or before the top died, then it can be an organism that caused this rot.
I believe that's what your lady there told me.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing that attention, again, can really be valuable. At the very beginning that you start developing some problems with your plants is to pull one out and really do a careful inspection. A lot of people wait just till it's way too late to...
Yeah, post-mortem is too late.
Post-mortem is...
Okay, Don, assuming I have this microorganism, what can I do?
Well...
For this year to, prevent it happening.
Well, there's only one good product that can be used called Vapam. If it's very important, you can put Vapam on I put it on with a sprinkling can. You'll have to read the amount. I usually put a little bit more on than they say. But the problem with Vapam is it doesn't work at in cold soils very well.
Mm-hmm.
It works fine in the greenhouse, but you put it in the cold soil, you're going to sterilize your soil, you'll kill these microorganisms, you'll kill your weeds. It's a wonderful thing, but your soil temperature should be around 60. Well, our soil temperatures on the surface don't get up to 60 until June. And then you have to put it on, leave it on for about a week or 10 days, cover it with black plastic, and let it cook, and then open it, aerate it, and it's another week. And by that time, it's already too late to be planting anything. So if you do have this problem, if anybody else has a problem, they think it's a disease organism, they should pull the stuff out in August. It's going to die anyway. Get rid of it. Then treat it while your soil is still warm. And just I just leave the plastic on until freeze up, and by then it's cooked pretty well.
Okay, let me ask you one more question.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to go to more of an Alaskan kind of flower, and I need to know something that will do well on a well-drained, good-soiled south slope and, you know, provide a lot of color. I like to take care of them.
You want a lot of color?
Yes.
Bright colors?
Bright colors.
Well, we have other things to think about. We have frosts, you know, in the fall, and sometimes I like to make a compromise with plants that will withstand the frost, because you get an extra month out of your garden that way. So I like to mix them up. Petunias will withstand a frost, but it kills the bud, so that all you have is a green plant there. And petunias, of course, are very, very one of the most popular. Marigolds are very sensitive to frost. Snapdragons, calendulas, pansies, of course, are very good, because they will take a freeze, a light freeze, and stay blooming. Stock is another one.
Nice fragrance.
Oh, I love the fragrance, the cinnamon-like fragrance of
good
stock.
Good cut flower.
Now, those are the ones that probably you'd want to put in there, or at least mix a few of them in, whether it's in a group of them here and a group of them there, so that you have something when that freeze hits.
Please.
I've seen some fantastic plantings of snaps, if you don't get the real tall ones.
Snapdragons. Yeah, there's some beautiful
colors.
They will
do beautifully. Takes a little longer for them to get established, but don't plant rows unless you really have to. That's a no-no in landscaping.
Do a little clumping.
Well, borders is one thing, mm-hmm. but borders are in rows, but... use groupings rather than just row of this, row of that, row of this, and row of that.
Well, thank you very much, Don.
Okay.
I'm talking to Ray Morgan, who's been with Cooperative Extension, did you tell me, 17 years?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's Cooperative Extension here. What did you do before that?
Cooperative Extension, Kentucky, for 11 years.
For 11 years. So you've made a whole lifelong career out of Cooperative Extension work.
Pretty much so.
Cold crops. We were talking, let's just talk about some cold crops. For people who aren't experienced in gardening in Fairbanks, those are crops that do very, very well here, actually. Could you say a little bit about cold crops, what their needs are,
yeah,
and what they are?
Yeah, the cold crops, we normally refer to them as a cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts. Those are the ones that come to mind first. Of course, we can also, such crops as lettuce and some of others will withstand light frost also. So in the cold, it's spelled C-O-L-E rather than mm-hmm. C-O-L-D.
Right.
And so those crops are primarily a leafy crop that we eat a part of the stalk itself, which means that it doesn't produce necessarily a fruit. like a tomato or does a squash. And so this gives you a key right away as to how you can manage that crop as well, relationship to fertilizer, weed control, and some of those kind of things. And when we talk about a vegetable that we're going to eat the plant, we usually think of a high nitrogen type fertilizer that we're going to use, regardless of whether you're an organic fertilizer person or whether you use commercial fertilizer. You ought to use a high nitrogen. And if you're looking at a fertilizer bag, there's usually three numbers on there. The first number is the nitrogen level, and it's a percentage level that's in that fertilizer bag. And so if those numbers, that first number is about the half as large as the next two numbers, which is phosphorus and potash in that order, that's the kind of fertilizer I'd use for my coal crops. For my other vegetables, I'd like to have the middle number higher, like my tomatoes and my squash, and that means the phosphorus should be a little higher because phosphorus is what makes their blossoms and the fruit part of the plant produce. Of course, it also does other things too, but that's a good kind of a rule of thumb to use in purchasing your fertilizer today if you haven't done that yet, is to ideally two different kinds of fertilizer for if you're growing a number of different crops. However, if you're going to only get one fertilizer, which some people do just that, probably the 10-20-20 fertilizer is an all-around fertilizer that would be best for a garden that's been in production for a while. If I had a new garden, I'd go with the 8-32-16. That would be the fertilizer I'd use. So that's the two options that I would give for people who have had gardens for a while, the spot that they're using, or for somebody, I think Kathy and I were talking a little earlier about she's going to start a new garden in a new spot. 8-32-16 for her would probably be the best route to go this year. I cover half my garden with black plastic.
Why is that?
And that's where I put my coal crops. After I fertilize and put down a irrigation tubing of some kind underneath the plastic, then I usually go in and just plant all my coal crops right directly through the black plastic and water underneath there, and I don't have to worry about the weeds. And I don't have to worry. Primarily, that's the reason I use black plastic, is control that chickweed, which is a real problem for us up here. Yeah. And then in the course where I use a clear plastic, I just use the row covers and don't try to cover the whole area, because you do need, sometimes you need to control the weeds underneath there, and it's be much easier to do that by hand if you have just row cover instead of complete cover of the garden.
What kind of irrigation? Do you have an elaborate irrigation system or...?
No, not too much. I just have a garden hose running from the house out to the garden, and underneath I use some twin wall chafing tubing, which is a brand name. There's other brands that you can use too, and this has some real fine pinholes in it about a foot apart that lets the water come out real slow. Now, it you have to put one row of that tubing for every row of cabbage or whatever you're using, whatever you're planting, underneath the plastic. And I do that under clear plastic and black plastic. It takes a lot less water when we do the plastic job, too, and that's condition control and weeds for the black plastic. It also conserves moisture.
So it doesn't evaporate so quickly.
Right. And the twin wall chafing, as well as the other brands of tubing, operates under very low pressure. You don't have to have but about probably somewhere in the 6 to 12 pounds of pressure. So if you don't want to turn on 40 pounds of pressure like comes out of your garden hose right close to the faucet, or you'll blow the hose up, actually. Yeah.
A lot of us add peat to our soil around here. I find that very helpful. The soil at our house was quite barren when we started, and we've brought a lot of peat in, and it's really made a difference. Also, the texture of the soil has improved substantially because of that.
Yeah. Peat does a couple of things, and for a new gardener, especially if you've got a subsoil where you built a house or something like that, I would certainly recommend you put on a minimum of 3 inches of peat as a kind of rule of thumb, and that does not only improves the tilt, but primarily the water-holding capacity. As you know, we live in a desert here in Interior Alaska. We only get about 10 inches of rain a year, and that's not very much. But if we lived anywhere else and had a longer growing season, we would have an awful dry condition here in Interior. And so that peat does a real good job for that. Now, one other thing peat does do is it's an acid, and so when you add an acid to your soil, you need to add perhaps some lime without a soil test. Kind of a rule of thumb is about 3 to 4 pounds of dolomitic limestone per 100 square feet when you're adding the peat to either your lawn or you're adding it to your garden. That's a pretty good rule of thumb to follow to sweeten that soil up.
Okay, so coal crops, about the only thing that happens in here in my experience is that we do get some root maggots with coal crops occasionally. And what is the prescribed treatment for that?
Well, root maggots affect not only coal crops but some of our other crops like radishes and turnips. The best material to use on that is a material called diazinon. You can also use wood ashes. Evidently works for some people sometimes, and things like your coal crops, you can put those around the base of the wood ashes to help control the little maggot once it hatches and tries to crawl down and get into the roots of the plant. That's where it works, underground. So theoretically, the wood ashes will be strong enough to either drive them away or to kill them when they're real tiny, almost microscopic in size. But the chemical that we're recommending is called diazinon, and probably a powdered form on the surface around the coal crops is about as effective way as any to do that. Now, when you're getting into turnips and radishes, of course, you can't do each individual plant like that, so you've got to cover the ground with the diazinon just after they come up or around about that time. And we don't usually have to worry about the root maggot fly, which looks like a little house fly, until about June the 15th here in Interior Alaska. So, and I recommend you don't use a chemical unless you have to have it of any kind. And so at about that time, when you start seeing some flies going around or observing your plants, if you see any eggs laid on the stem or underneath the leaf, then that would be the time to use the weed control.
I grew up in the Midwest, and tomatoes are the sort of heart and soul of a garden there, and everyone gets into very heated arguments about which kind, beefsteaks versus fantastics versus et cetera, et cetera. Could you, Ray, give us a sort of tomato 101 course here, greenhouse versus not greenhouse, what we can do with our tomatoes?
Well, first let me say something about varieties. There are a large number of varieties in some of the, what do they call them, the girl or the boy varieties, some of the big boys or the
early boy or early girl,
some of those are pretty good. One of the greenhouses here promotes those a lot. We also have one individual here that developed a tomato variety that's started right here in Fairbanks area, Subarctic 25.
John Holm.
Yeah, and John is also improving on that variety now, and he's going to come out with another variety here. He was telling me the other day pretty soon that it's going to be even better than the Subarctic 25, and these are outside tomatoes we're talking about. There's another variety of tomato called the Tannenol, which is a larger fruit than any of the others, or at least larger than some of the girl or boy varieties that we call. The Tannenol variety was developed here in Alaska, and it's a good one for outside too. Again, just with clear plastics on the way you can do outside tomatoes. Now, when you get in the greenhouse, of course, your varieties are just about unlimited. There's a lot of varieties that will do good here that will do good downstate. They're not prone to the long daylight conditions of bolting like some of our other crops may be. So tomato varieties in the greenhouse is pretty much your own selections, but the Tannenol does pretty good in the greenhouse. It's a good variety. Production outside, you do. I've been successful the last couple of years of putting my tomatoes right in front of the house on the south side. That way, I get enough protection and enough heat and warmth. And in fact, the grass is already 2 feet tall in front of the house, whereas 5 feet away from the house, it's not even growing yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that seems to be enough to be able to get the tomatoes to do good for me. Whereas in the gardens, my garden haven't been very much successful because I'm a little bit shade some parts of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So you need the full sun for tomatoes. You need the clear plastic, lots of water, a variety that grows a short growing season, and you might try the Tannenau. It's a pretty good variety. It's still recommended.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in the greenhouse, even if it's a simple visqueen greenhouse, what kind of pruning instructions, feeding instructions, support instructions? Before we went on the air, you're talking about a new kind of water blanket that's being developed. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's evidently a water blanket, which is a double layer plastic sealed to make tubes, and tubes must be about an inch or so in diameter. And we've seen these on TV, I think, here recently, and from Anchorage. So far, I haven't heard of anybody in Fairbanks that has any, but what you do, this would be for outside tomatoes, which would be forming their own little miniature greenhouse. You fill the tubes full of water. Evidently, the sun warms the water up in the daytime and gives off the heat at night to give that extra warmth. And you just place these around a tomato plant. Now, we haven't tried them. I have never seen them produce up here, anything produced in them. So I can't really recommend that's a good idea, but there are people in Anchorage that is recommending them. But going into the greenhouse, one thing that I'd certainly recommend, two or three things to be real cautious about. One is don't use fertilizer in the greenhouse like you'd use outside. Use only water-soluble fertilizer. That's the first thing. Reason for that is the salts from the regular fertilizer will build up and cause you to have a lot of salt toxicity, which you just about got to change your soil then when you get that kind of problem of using fertilizer like 832-16. So always use water soluble in the greenhouse. Another thing that the folks do up at the university is in the greenhouse is every year they add a small amount of trace minerals or trace elements to the greenhouse just as a precaution. And these are things like copper, zinc, boron, magnesium, some of those minor nutrients, and it only takes a few ounces per 100 square feet. So as a rule of thumb, it's a good idea to add some of those each year as a preventive method. Now, another thing we see a lot in the greenhouses with tomatoes, particularly, is blossom end rot, and that's often caused by stress related to two or three things. One is uneven watering, perhaps a lack of calcium or lime, and too high of a heat. And so if you're having blossom end rot on your tomatoes, you should look at those three things to make sure that you're kindly somewhere in the ballpark in temperature in a greenhouse, where cucumbers and tomatoes should not be over 90 degrees. If you go much over 90, then you're going to destroy the pollen on the blossoms, which you won't know for a few weeks later that your little tomatoes look like they're going to form, and then suddenly they all fall off.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been because they got too hot. Of course, getting too cold will do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we have more and more people here in interior Alaska that are starting small greenhouses, and it's a good thing to do. To really be successful, and I would advise getting a small heater sometime kind of go with it, and either a propane, of course, one automatic propane, or a little a trailer heater of kerosene or something would be, you know, might be adaptable to a greenhouse too.
Keep it warmer in the beginning of the year when the nights get real chilly, and also to give it a little extra heat. Ventilation is very important. Need some fan or something so that air can move and, in fact, the heat does not build up.
I like to use or recommend that you use some type of an automatic ventilator, and there are a number of those small ones, inexpensive, on the market that will open up a window or side window or window in the top for less than probably $25 or $30. You can buy one of those, and you don't have to get up 4 o'clock in the morning and open the vents
to
the greenhouse.
Open the windows. This may be difficult on the air, but there are little suckers that grow in on tomatoes when the branches are coming out. Are those supposed to be trimmed off?
Yes, in a greenhouse particularly, I'd like to recommend that you use a string to string those up. And just to one main stem, take the suckers, as we call them. They'll be growing right at the where the leaf comes out on the main stem and pull
the Y-joint.
Yeah, just pull those out before they get over 6 inches long. Take them out of the greenhouse and throw them away. Then when your tomato gets about the sixth cluster of tomato set on that vine, you should pinch the top out of that vine. There's no need in letting all the nutrients go into producing more blossoms and more vine that you aren't going to need, because about six clusters is probably all you're going to be able to mature before, I hate to say this, freeze up again.
Yeah. I'm talking this morning to Pat Wagner, Grant Metecky, Gordon Harrod, and we're talking about gardening. Okay, we have lots of calls. Let's take one first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question.
Sure.
I've heard that you can plant potatoes by simply putting a potato on the ground and covering it with black plastic. And I just wondered if you'd had any experience with that and know how well it works.
Okay, thank you for that question. Do we...
Never heard of it.
I think what you're thinking of is, in a lot of places, potatoes will be planted into a mulch rather than into soil. So they'll plant them into straw or something like that and grow them. That has been done. But you really need... The roots radiate in all directions from the seed piece, and you really need to stick that seed piece under the ground. Just putting it under plastic, it will get too dry.
Sam tried something last year where someone told him that if you take old tires, and we happen to be Alaskan, so we have a lot of old tires, and you plant the potato in the old tire, and then as it grows, you add more soil and add another tire and so on. And it wasn't a very scientific experiment, but we were disappointed, actually. It wasn't a better yield than we had from our regular hills in the garden. So...
Yeah, I think that's there's a system of planting potatoes in a bucket and just adding soil to the bucket, and it seems like sort of magical, because it never how much did you let it get out of the does it stick out in the did the plant stick out into the air
a little bit you know and as it grew up he added another tire. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
We're from Montana, and there we gardened with the French intensive method. And I was wondering if that would be worth going through the initial trouble of digging up the beds up here, and if they're familiar with it at all.
That's a real deep digging method where you keep that?
Right. The beds are fairly deep, and they're narrow. Uh-huh. They're about 3 foot wide and then usually long.
I
so
tried
no
that.
There's no mulching needed.
Okay.
I tried that and did a lot of... I dug down. I didn't do it all by hand. I dug down pretty deeply and then rototilled deeper so that I had maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet deep. And then I did some other beds nearby that I just did the normal things, used lots of compost and just rototilled, you know, 7 inches deep or so. And I couldn't tell any difference between the deeply dug bed and the other one. So I think that the soil is too cold down at depth, and so that it doesn't function the same up here at all. So it seemed to me to be a complete waste of time.
Okay. Another question, too, is just as starting off our first garden up here, what would you say would be the best way to go as far as initial crops?
Good question. You're just beginning and you want to start easy and
do
things that you know are going to be successful and not fussy, don't try asparagus. All right, well, I'll have Grant or Pat answer that question.
Well, I think there's really a long list, and I guess the things maybe be easier to concentrate on the things to stay away from. And I think I'd forget about lima beans. We've never been able to grow them. And sweet corn can be grown here, but it's... chancy if you don't have a real good site, and you do need clear plastic, so that's something I'd stay away from. It helps to grow things like cucumbers, zucchini, with a clear plastic mulch down, those things that like warm soils. Peppers are iffy. Eggplants are very iffy.
And they attract aphids.
Yeah.
Dread aphid.
Yeah.
Probably the key to the strategy for growing corn, besides the clear plastic mulch, is getting it in as soon as you can. And as you know, this year we like to get ours in somewhere between the 12th and the 15th, and early as possible. And I don't think we'll make it.
Of May.
Right, 12th to 15th of May. Soon as you can get onto a field and till it without turning up big mud clots, as soon as you've dried out enough so that you can till a field, till it. If you're going to use clear plastic, you should put down some sort of a soaker hose or drip irrigation or something underneath the plastic so you don't have to water the individual holes. Then what we do is we work on a 3-foot-wide row. The rows are spaced 5 feet apart. That way we can lay our plastic easily. But at home, if you're laying it by hand, you can go a little closer. The plastic should be 3 feet. So if you have a 4-foot roll, then you can dig a ditch either side of the center of your row, 3 foot wide, with a shovel. Just lay your plastic down and fill it up. But, of course, before you do that, you have to get your seed in. So what you want to do is fertilize, till, lay down a hose right near the center of the row, and then go along, and we put ours three seeds to a hill, three seeds to a spot, and space them a foot apart within the row. Then tamp that down and roll the plastic over. Now, if you're going to use herbicide, of course, you have to put the herbicide down. Most of them are set up so you put the herbicide down after you put your seed in the ground.
Corn seed comes treated.
Almost always.
Yeah.
Almost always. What is that for?
It's for fungal diseases.
Now that we're talking about cold soils, a lot of the fungal diseases thrive in the cold soils, and so seeds are treated to prevent.
So you have to make sure that your seeds are treated. They've got that pink stuff on
it. It usually helps.
Okay. And do you have a recommendation for specific kinds of corn?
Yeah, the first, there's two varieties that are very early. One's Yukon Chief, and it's an open-pollinated corn, which means it's not a hybrid. So it has some variability, and the ears are small. It's rather short and not the best-looking corn plant you've ever seen, but it will get you the earliest corn. So if it's your first try with sweet corn, I'd use Yukon Chief. And then maybe if you had some more room, I'd use Polar V, which comes a few days later usually. And it's a hybrid corn. Its ears are, I guess, about 7-8 inches, isn't it, wouldn't you say? More than 6, anyway. Good eating corn, and it would be the second recommendation. Then when you find that you become an expert at growing corn and you want to take a few chances during the season, Early V is an excellent variety. It tastes very good. It's longer. The kernel spacing is real regular, very tasty, but it's a little later, so it's chancy. I've never gotten it at my house. We get it at the farm every year. So I got a lot of shade at home.
So how big a block of corn do you have to get it to germinate?
You should, ideally, 3 rows should be enough to get good cross-pollination.
And clear plastic, unless you're in some place where there's no weeds, there's a
penalty without using herbicide. With corn, Don Dinkle, we never did it, but Don Dinkle would often just leave the weeds to grow a little bit and stomp them down, because the corn is a fast grower and it puts out a lot of roots, and it essentially is just out competing the weeds a little bit. You're not going to get ideal growth that way. And the other thing you can do is get nice and messy and reach in around those holes and pull all those weeds out of there. Often, if you don't disturb the soil too much when you pull the weeds, you have to weed less under clear plastic because there's no new weed seeds coming in and germinating. So
depends on how good a job you did the year before in keeping those weeds down.
Indeed.
I think corn is one of those things, if, you know, obviously you have to take a chance on it by starting early in the year. And if we have a good, hot, dry summer, which I understand you used to have in years before I moved here, it is really a thrill to be sitting in Fairbanks in August eating corn on the cob and
fresh
tomatoes. And as most of you know who have had experience eating good, fresh corn, it really converts very quickly from sugar to starch. And so there is really nothing like fresh corn out of the garden. My mother used to get the water boiling before we went and picked the corn. I don't know if that was really necessary, but it really is delicious. But, of course, you can't tell what kind of summer we're going to have. In some years, it's just really a fizzle, and it takes a lot of space. So, hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
One of my favorite crops to grow up here. And also my favorite to eat is sugar pod peas, or edible pod peas.
Uh-huh, sugar snaps.
And it's also been the one that I've had the worst luck with. It seems like my crop always, about three-quarters of it ends up too late in the season and gets frosted. And I was wondering if it would do any good to try and force the peas to sprout them before I put them in the ground, especially this year when the ground's going to be super cold.
No, but they've got a new one out called Sugar Ann, and I would recommend that one. It's maybe two or three weeks earlier than the original Sugar Snap, and it's also a real compact plant so that it doesn't get 6 feet tall and you have to worry about staking it and tying it up. And it's an All-America selection that was new last year or the year before, so it should be available in the garden stores this year. I would say as far as sprouting peas early, the way the root system grows and all, they're not a good plant to transplant, so I wouldn't recommend that.
Well, we're such nuts about peas in our house that we start them, but we start them in peat pots so that they don't have such a
shock.
You know, and it
you
just...
You are nuts, aren't you?
When you usually our spacing, you consider, you know, they're about an inch apart and you grow them in rows, long rows. That's a lot of
work.
Well,
we have about 60 of them growing very nicely. And it does, it really gives a jump. I'm also a very, a real big fan of sweet peas, and I start them early, and I have sweet peas before a lot of people have them, so I think it's worth doing. But
peas are not like beans in that they're real temperature sensitive. They are a cool season crop, and so as soon as you can work your ground,
yeah, you can get them in quite early. I like to grow sweet peas too, and what I do is try and get them in again around the 15th, somewhere around there. Yeah, mm-hmm. And while they're germinating, I cover that area with clear plastic, mm-hmm. and then as soon as they come up,
it comes off.
And then they'll just let them start to go.
Because they don't mind cool feet.
And the other thing
you
about...
You could try that with your edible potted peas too, the plastic.
Peas, yeah.
To help them germinate, but then once they've germinated, they do not need warm soil.
Yeah.
Okay.
And another thing with the getting back to the sweet peas is to seed them real heavily. You can really put a ton of sweet peas in one little spot and get good growth out of them.
They don't mind crowding, although I don't think that you get the best germination rate from sweet peas. I don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah, they're a little
the fussy.
Soaking overnight before you put them in is another good thing to do, mm-hmm. to get them started, get them imbibing that water and softened up. And there was, on the sugar ant pea, it comes in about 10 days earlier than the sugar snap.
Oh,
so
nice.
It is a real good bet. And another thing I don't know if Pat mentioned is it's very short, so that you don't need to stake it as much as you need the sugar snap.
So
it's a lot nicer. It's nice development. And I guess what they're working on now is stringless sugar snaps.
Oh.
So hopefully that'll be here in a few years.
Peas, especially for Alaskan gardeners, are one thing where all of that experimental work is really paying off, mm-hmm. for us. Mm-hmm. My grandparents had a farm in Canada, and they grew a lot of peas, but I remember spending hours sitting on the front stoop of the house shelling peas, you know, for this huge group of farmhands that was going to eat them, and it was a lot. It was, talk about labor intensive. And that sugar snap, for those of you who haven't tried it, you can eat the pea, the pod and the pea, and they're big English peas. They're not like the snow peas.
They're real a much meatier.
Much meatier pea.
Thicker pod, yeah.
And you can, in fact, shell them later on in the season if you'd like, but you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, all through the program I've been hearing references to clear plastic mulch. Is there anything wrong with dark plastic?
There's nothing wrong with it, but, and there's, well, we'll get into a little controversy, not a controversy, but it's just something we don't know yet about dark plastic mulch. If you use dark plastic mulch by itself, just as a single layer of mulch on the ground, it does not tend to warm the soil, and in some cases actually cools it. And the reason is that although dark is an excellent absorber of solar radiation, none of it is transmitted through it, and the only way that the heat is transmitted is by contact with the soil. Well, when you have a layer of plastic laying on the soil, the contact is really poor. So the black will absorb and heat up, but it does transmit very little of that to the soil. The clear acts like a greenhouse. The light rays go through, heat the soil, and that heated soil then changes the radiation to longer wavelengths that can't get through the clear back out again. So that's why the clear does such a good job heating. Now, we also grow strawberries where we use tents over the top of a base mulch, clear plastic tents over the top of a base mulch that's clear plastic. And you can also use black there. And at this point, we don't know whether the clear or the black is better in that situation, because the tent already creates a heated environment above that plastic. And it may be then that the trapping of heat by the clear plastic in that already warmed environment is not as important. And, of course, the great advantage of using black is there's no weeding except right where you make the holes and the light gets through. And another thing that you can use black for is that's very nice is to you can grow your cold season crops through black plastic and not have to weed, and plus cut down on the amount of watering you have to do.
Yeah, I found with growing cabbage plants, family plants through through black plastic that I've just been much more successful with cabbage, with broccoli and cauliflower. And so it's just you can use a run a lawnmower up and down the aisle in between to take down the weeds, and so weeding. But the so it's good on weeds, and for some reason the plants seem to grow better under black plastic than they do under nothing. You know, it's I'm not sure what why. You know
and,
why?
And you're talking about cold crops now, which don't have such rigorous warm soil requirements.
Right, right, right.
So there, the fact that they're missing that greenhouse effect is not so critical.
No.
Right.
So why do cabbage family plants grow so well under with black plastic?
Well, that hasn't been our experience, but it may be watering is one possibility. You know that you're you know if you're just growing in silty soil, I think like we are in most of our things without much amendment. It's nice to amend your soil with peat, but when you're growing on acres, it becomes an impractical thing to do that much. And it may be easier to keep your soil moist and moisture conditions closer to the ideal under the black plastic than it is under the with plain soil. Yeah.
But then you have to use some kind of drip method or...
Yeah, right.
Need your irrigation under there. Also, though, we do get a little heating from the black plastic, don't we? Isn't it usually?
Yeah, on occasions, but it's hard to say that on balance it's much greater than anything else. There's times when it's cooler underneath that black.
Right. With the clear, though, it does tend to cool off when it doesn't have light. So, like at night, it loses a little more heat, whereas the black seems to be more conservative, gives a more even soil temperature.
Hmm. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to comment on the mulching. I read, I think it was in Alaska Magazine, about some gardener, and I think it was here in Fairbanks, somebody who used carpet as a mulch. And I was just wondering if you had any knowledge about how that works.
They
said that they, I guess, basically used it just like plastic, but it was a carpet that didn't have any shag on it, you know, maybe a quarter inch thick or so.
Mm-hmm. It was like AstroTurf, I think, indoor-outdoor type.
They'd taken it out of a room and moved it out into the garden.
Right.
We did some work on that last year. And we didn't do yields, but we did do temperatures underneath the various coverings, underneath the clear when it was shaded and not shaded, underneath the black when it was shaded and not shaded, and underneath AstroTurf. And the soil underneath the AstroTurf did get some heating during very hot days, but most of the time it actually cooled the soil a little bit because it acts as an insulator. I think it helps if it's a darker color. Ours was a medium green, I think.
But it had a dark back.
With a dark back. And so that's right where I think we got some of the heating. So it's a nice way to make a very neat garden. It'll keep your weeds down. I think it's probably pretty close to neutral in terms of heating and cooling so far. But there is the potential of it acting like an insulator. And mulches that insulate the soil from the sun and the heat, of course, are detrimental. So we're going to look at that a little more closely in the future.
We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
We burn coal in our home fire here, and I was wondering if we would get any benefit from putting the ashes in our garden.
Good question. What about ashes?
Some ashes are a bit too alkaline, so it sometimes can create problems. I generally, to get my garden to melt faster in the spring, take all the ashes from my wood stove and spread them out over the top. Last year, I think it was probably a cold day, and I was maybe hot-footing out in my slippers one time or something, spreading some ashes around, and left a big pile in one spot. And I remembered that spot when later on a lot of my flowers died right there. So I'd say you could put some on, but have your soil checked regularly so that you don't push the pH way up. And I'm not exactly sure as far as coal ash goes, but it is a good thing to do when you're trying to get your snow to melt, because it really will increase the melting. You get that dark color on top of the snow, and it really melts it off a lot faster.
Well, is not the soil around, around spruce trees, does that not tend to be more acidic, and maybe you could balance it a little bit with that alkaline?
Yeah, but that unless you're in a peat bog, that layer is really thin. So once you mix that with the rest of our soil, which tends to be a little bit basic, your pH really is not going to be anywhere near low. So it's not usually the case unless you're growing in a peat, real mucky peat soil, that our pHs are real low around here. Usually they're close to neutral or above.
But that is something that you really highly recommend doing, is checking getting your soil tested.
It's awfully nice to know the pH of your soil. It's very seldom when you need to know the amount of salts in it, because normally our soils are pretty low in fertility and we need to fertilize. But if you have some unusual case, a number of years back, we got some soil from outside the Chamber of Commerce cabin where they spread salt to melt the snow all the time. And I couldn't read it on the meter, and I thought somebody was playing a joke on me, because I kept diluting it twice and twice and twice till I had it so diluted. I finally got on the scale, and by that time it was almost difficult to calculate back and figure what the concentrations were. It was so high. But normally the fertility of our soils are low, and unless you've really been dumping fertilizer on, you're not going to have much carryover from year to year. The other thing is most of those things will leach with all the water that goes through in the spring. But the pH is important, because a lot of things that you do can change the pH, and it's nice to know what it is.
How do we get our pH tested?
Cooperative Extension Service does that, and you need to give them some lead time.
Couple weeks, 3 weeks.
I don't know.
Probably more than that.
It's too late now.
It's probably your best bet for soil testing is to take your samples in the fall and send them in then, and then you'll know for the next spring what your situation is and if you need to do anything.
Okay.
One nice thing about if your pH does get too high, it's relatively easy to bring it down by adding peat, because peat is a acid substance.
And you can buy peat in town by the truckload, and
right. And it's a good soil amendment.
It lightens that heavy soil up, and that's very good. Is there anything else people should be adding now that it's not too late to add if they are working on their soil?
Well, it's certainly not too late to add peat or compost if you're composting, and get that in, work it in when you fertilize and then till.
Or fertilizer.
Yeah, right, for sure. You should add your fertilizer. I think another thing to expand on that is any way that you can increase the amount of organic matter in your soil, whether it's compost or manure. Now, there is a danger with manure in that you do tend to get more weeds, but a lot of people are willing to take that chance. And then, of course, there are things you can do with manure to reduce the weeds. And another thing to watch out for in manure is if it comes out of a stable, you don't want to get it with too much sawdust in it. That just doesn't help you too much.
Nitrogen robber.
Yeah, right. And the other thing that we always do is to till all our leftover plant parts back in the fall, because you want to keep that organic matter in there. And if you do it in the fall, it has time to break down in the rest of the fall and the early spring, so that you don't have large chunks. If you do it in the spring, you're really not you lose a lot of the benefit, because the stuff just doesn't break down as well after it's dried out so much.
There's a lot to talk about, but even over the period of 39 years that I've gardened, every year I am shocked that I find something out that I didn't know. because you can always find out something new. You can always learn something you didn't know. And I'm not so well informed as I'd like to be. You just never get that way.
Gardening's a humbling experience. Just when I feel like I've got a particular thing figured out, and okay, now I know how to grow this flower, I'm not going to have any problem with it anymore. Boy, the next year is totally something different situation.
Well, it's not one of these situations where you put a seed together with soil, together with water, together with fertilizer. One, two, three, plus four, you know, would equal a 10. It doesn't. Sometimes it might equal a 11 or a 6 or a 3, and then you say, oh, my goodness, I forgot about that. And I think that the one thing I read in publications where it says, don't keep this too wet and don't keep it too dry. Well, too wet to some people and too dry to some people, these are inaccurate or very hard to measure. And some people stick their finger in and say, well, that's just right in the soil on top. And some people stick their same finger or their finger in and say, well, now that's too wet for that plant. And there's this beautiful place between too wet and too dry that certain plants love. You shouldn't be too dogmatic in saying, well, this and this and this and this are the conditions, because some of these, the experienced gardener, there's no such thing as a green thumb. I tell people it's the brown thumb full of dirt that counts.
This is Susan McInnes again, and today you've been listening to the Best of Home Fires on Sunday at noon. We'll have more shows on gardening, I hope, as the summer goes on, and I hope we can get Patty to come into the studio as one of our guests on Sunday at noon for a program on gardening. Thanks to Patty, her guests, and her callers, and thanks to Katie Henry for engineering this show for us today, the Best of Home Fires on Gardening. Next week, join me, please, for the beginning of a two-part interview with former Governor Walter J. Hickel. Dr. Klaus Naske from the University of Alaska College of Liberal Arts History Department will be here with us. We'll spend an hour, the first of 2 hours, with Walter Hickel. I think you'll find it interesting. Funds for the production of Sunday at Noon were provided by the KUAC Public Affairs Programming Fund. Its contributors include the University of Alaska Fairbanks, College of Liberal Arts, and Dirk Lumertime. Thanks, as always, to my engineers for this show, Katie Henry, especially today, also Riley Woodford, and to Carla Tinella, executive producer for Sunday at Noon. This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. We are rebroadcast in Healy at 101.7 megahertz over translator K269AD, in Glen Allen at 92.1 megahertz on K221BL, in Nenana at 91.1 megahertz on K216AN, in Delta at 91.7 megahertz on K219AQ, and in Circle Central and Circle Hot Springs at 91.7 megahertz on K219AD. Stay with us on KUAC for Radio Kronos. Coming up next, it's 1 o'clock. Local broadcast of Weekend Edition is made possible in part by a grant from Hoffer Glass. Hi, I'm Susan McInnes, and I'm your host for KUAC FM's Sunday at Noon. Today, I'm inviting you to spend an hour with Patty Kostelic, her guests, and callers for a program we've called The Best of Home Fires on Gardening. For those who are not initiated, Home Fires was a weekly favorite for KUAC FM, and some of the best shows turned out were on gardening. Patty put them together. Today, engineer Katie Henry has brought them back, reaching back into the Best of Home Fires to create today's show. We hope you'll enjoy it. We hope you'll listen and then get out in your garden and enjoy that as well. With no further ado, I turn you over to Patty Kostelic. Happy gardening, everyone.